How can we know the time of crisis has arrived?
Everyone in the West has dug his head into the sand like ostriches. No one wants to admit these problems exist.
Do you feel that your life is meaningless? That you can't make a difference in these crazy and uncertain times?
Then maybe you need a dose of Radio Eco Shock, active sound from the green side. Hi, I'm Alex Smith. Deep in the kitchen of capitalism, a foul smell is coming out. Financial instruments are melting down along with the ecosphere. Today we'll ask indie writer Mike Whitney what is going on behind the money curtain. Why is the American dollar falling, and will the consumer empire fall with it? In the second part of the show, a Canadian educator and author, Ian Angus, claims capitalism has to fall anyway to save the climate. Speaking at a Vancouver campus recently, Angus says the remaining alternatives are eco-socialism or barbarism, climate and capitalism, coming up in the second half hour. First, we're going to fly through some critical news. Your planet is on life support. Here are just a few of the stories we're watching. The Japanese have announced they will go whaling again this year with the ill-starred factory meat machine, the Nissan Maru. Disregarding world opinion, the Japanese fleet will murder up to 1,000 minke whales, plus 50 of the much-loved and lately endangered humpbacked whales. Stories are popping up all over the internet of customers canceling orders for Japanese cars and electronics. The boycott has begun spontaneously. Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Society have launched the protest ship, the Robert Hunter, from Australia. Greenpeace will no doubt send their boat, the Esperanza. The whales themselves are defenseless. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has issued its final report for the next 4 years. They warn of rising seas, fires, floods, and mass death from human-made greenhouse gases. The scientists estimate that up to 30% of all species could go extinct.
30% of species could go extinct.
Other people, including some of the world's best scientists, warn this IPCC report has already been watered down by governments, and it's behind the actual progress of climate change. Our fate, should we continue with fossil fuels as the basis of our society, will be much worse, they say. Find that in Der Spiegel online for November 19, 2007. All this comes just days before representatives from all the world's governments meet in Bali, Indonesia, to work out a new agreement, or not. No doubt you have heard the news about the leaders of Iran and Venezuela uniting, threatening $200 a barrel oil if Iran is attacked. Wailing over money lost to the falling dollar drowned out this strange news. The king of Saudi Arabia complained that media coverage of this rare OPEC oil meeting failed to report a combined Arab state effort to combat climate change. Hoping to keep oil revenues coming in, the Saudis and their partners are tossing $750 million into a fund to develop carbon capture and sequestration. It may be less than a day's revenues, but it shows the fear in the oil industry that people will wake up from their damaged homes and lives to demand clean alternatives. Maybe that is why the American oil industry has launched a new round of Feel Good About Oil TV ads. Oil, it tastes so good. Speaking of fossil fuel wreckage, an article just published in the journal Science finds that Hurricane Katrina was the biggest eco-catastrophe in American history. One of the authors, George Hurt, spelled H-U-R-T-T, a professor at the University of New Hampshire, says that satellite images suggest the storm killed 320 million trees across 5 states. The rotting wood and leaves would add up to 100 million metric tons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. All that carbon dioxide could make storms worse, generating more damage, another positive feedback loop. Find out more in a good article by Patrick Johnson, spelled J-O-N-S-S-O-N, of the Christian Science Monitor, published November 19, 2007. Meanwhile, the ship Weatherbird 2, owned by Planktos Corporation, has been spotted in Bermuda by another Sea Shepherd ship. Plankto CEO Russ George has sworn to dump up to 100 tons of iron into the sea near the Galapagos Islands in a massive experiment, creating algae blooms. He hopes to capture carbon dioxide from the air. The international body governing sea dumping, the London Dumping Convention, has said such large-scale commercial dumping should not happen. The U.S. EPA says no U.S. ships will be involved, so there's nothing they can do. Well, that begs the question, has Planktos Corp. hired another ship to do the deed? Why is their Weatherbird 2 sailing in the wrong direction? The claimed carbon credits would be worth millions, but who would buy them? Closer to home, but not lost, is the 46-day hunger strike by Donna Dillman. She is protesting uranium prospecting in rural eastern Ontario, Canada. Over 200 people accompanied the shaking and depleted grandmother to the local government office, but the doors were locked against her. Apparently, the Canadian government would rather let you die than open the doors to public concern about polluting nuclear business. 2 weeks from now, Radio EcoShock will open those doors. We'll interview Jim Harding, a man who fought off uranium mining in his home province of Saskatchewan, Canada, all his life. We'll talk about his new book, Canada's Deadly Secret, Saskatchewan Uranium and the Global Nuclear System. Canada, you know, provided uranium for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We provided the know-how for the bomb in India and Pakistan. Saskatchewan produces one-third of all uranium burned in the reactors built into bombs and into depleted uranium weapons for the whole world. That story coming up on Radio EcoShock. China has now the largest company in the world. As it opened in trading, PetroChina Company became the planet's first trillion-dollar corporation. Even if the stock was wildly inflated, even if it drops to half that price, PetroChina would still be worth more than its next competitor, ExxonMobil. Is this the beginning of a new era as the East rises and the West stumbles? Stay tuned as we investigate the troubles of America with independent journalist Mike Whitney.
Captain's log, emergency report. We are fast being sucked into the hideous vortex of a black hole.
Bulletins from the Titanic, Steady as She Sinks. That's the title of an article November 13th in the alternative journal Counterpunch. It's by Mike Whitney, an independent journalist from Washington State. Whitney is a dissident voice who publishes widely on foreign debacles and financial affairs. He makes a lot of complex issues visible to the rest of us, and we have him on the phone today. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you took the time to talk with us. Look, I'm seeing a lot of multi-billion dollar loss announcements and followed by smooth assurances that everything's fine. It's kind of like, you know, attention shoppers go to the mall and save Christmas. Tell us, what is really happening out there?
Well, I think I should give you a thumbnail sketch so that people have some kind of broader idea of where this originated and where it's all headed and why it's going to have, I think, potentially catastrophic effects on not just the American economy, but the global financial system. And we hear a lot about the meltdown in subprime loans. And subprime loans, this actually originated with the Federal Reserve between year 2002 and 2004, when they lowered interest rates below the rate of inflation and pumped trillions of dollars of low-interest credit into the system. And when central banks do that, it creates like a tidal wave that has to find different estuaries to release itself, and it creates a frenzy of speculative activity. And in this case, since the dot-com bubble had burst and people were no longer interested in investing their money in technology, it found its way into the housing sector. And the housing total mortgage value increased by $5.5 trillion in a six-year period, which is completely unprecedented and had nothing to do with normal supply and demand situation. It had to do with cheap money being available with lowered standards of loaning at the banks. So these lower standards fall into many different categories of loans, but the one that gets most attention is the subprime, and there are $1.5 trillion dollars worth of subprime loans out there, and they're expected to default at a rate of approximately 20 to 25%. That's a lot of people going out of business or losing their homes. But the bigger picture that people miss in this entire situation is that the subprime situation is merely the beginning of a much bigger problem. And that problem is that those loans have been amplified many times over in the secondary and the stock market through derivatives. And so if you take a $400,000 loan and then you put it in a hedge fund and it's leveraged at a margin of 10 to 1, you have a $4 million problem, okay? But when that problem is further amplified to, 10 times above that or 15 times beyond that with credit default swaps and options and other hedges that are available in this huge world of structured finance that is just creating more and more expansion of debt upon itself, then you have the possibility of this spilling over into the broader global economy. And that's why we see that as this thing is unwinding, that banks in Germany, France, England, and any other place where these loans, these opaque, very complex, what they call CDOs or mortgage-backed securities, are holding these assets are having difficulty because these things have lost a tremendous amount of their value, and as they unwind, the banks don't have the wherewithal, the capital reserve, to back them up. And in a nutshell, that's kind of it.
And I've been hearing that they can't actually figure out what some of these things are worth. They've been multiplied so many times and changed around that by the time your pension fund or mine has bought into it, now when they try and unwind it, they can't put it back together.
Well, you know, I'm sure glad that you brought that up. Because we are at the very beginning phase of this. When you mentioned pension funds, the pension funds probably are carrying more of this toxic derivative sludge than are the banks. And already we're seeing that the banks are teetering on the brink of insolvency because they can't offload $200 or $250 billion of this junk that there's no longer a market for. But to clarify what you just said, I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal, and the author was talking about a meeting he had earlier in the month with Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. And when he asked Bernanke, what is it most you would like to know about the subprime dilemma that we're facing right now? And Bernanke answered, I would like to know what those damn things are worth. Okay. Now, if that doesn't send a shiver up your spine, it certainly did mine. And I'll tell you why. The central bank is also one of our prime regulators for the entire financial system. And you're talking about this entire web of trillions of dollars of derivatives that were sold into the secondary market and which are haunting the housing market right now and causing unprecedented foreclosures. And he's saying he doesn't know what they're worth. This is a system that's completely out of control. I mean, you're talking about basically handing the hen house over to the foxes and saying, do with it what you will in the name of free market exchange. And this is a real tragedy.
And now I read that Citigroup and some other banks, as they flounder around, are trying to set up some sort of special fund. And I hear the big bite on the taxpayer coming to bail out what were really fantasy investments.
Well, the super SIV that you're talking about, the banks are actually going to provide their own money for that. But the reason that won't work is that they're trying to buy time so that people will not know what these assets that they're carrying are really not worth what they think they're what they're supposed to be valued at. In other words, State Street is responsible for a $1.5 billion CDO, one of these derivatives again that are related by mortgage securities, and they are liquidating that CDO right now. And it's a AAA rated CDO that has been regraded to a B or a triple B, which means that it will probably fetch somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 cents on the dollar. Now, if you take $200 billion of these that are on the bank's balance sheet, and I'm talking about the big banks here, okay? I'm talking about, you know, Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, et cetera, Lehman Brothers. And all of a sudden you say, well, you know, the assets that you thought were worth $200 billion are actually worth about $40 billion. Where are they going to come up with the money? Where are they going to come up with the capital reserves? This is a tremendous issue, and no one really knows how they can solve it or if they can solve it.
And, you know, we were talking, or I was mentioning, that possibly it could come to government bailout as the savings and loan did. But now let's move a little bit to the U.S. deficit, which was recently authorized to go from $8 trillion to over $9 trillion. And now they've topped that fantastic fund already of $9 trillion. And the big owners of that American debt are, as we know, China, Japan, and Saudi Arabia. And it seems like those foreign investors have taken a real bath as the dollar drops, and may already be getting out with other currencies like the euro. So what I'm wondering about is, you know, some environmentalists have been promoting a $500 billion government spending plan, maybe with the new Democratic government, to build a new energy economy and lots of green jobs, and it sounds great, but I wonder if there's going to be anything left to spend even keeping our hospitals open and our schools, much less starting a new alternative energy economy. Well, what is your read on that?
Well, of course, many people believe that the whole supply-side economics theory and cutting taxes for the wealthy, $300, $400 billion a year, that revenue is not coming in and creating these deficits, was in fact designed to crash the system so that we could privatize the public sector and take all the public assets and put them up for auction at the lowest at fire sale rates. That could be what is happening. I mean, certainly that has been our modus operandi around the world in many of the developing countries, et cetera, that we get corrupt officials in there, we crash their economy, then we come in and the whole thing is privatized, everything down to education, oil resources, water, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not so much as a conspiracy theory as it is a lesson in history. So is this happening to the United States right now? I'm not sure. I'm sure that whether their plan originally was to depreciate the dollar intentionally to make us more competitive manufacturing-wise, that it's backfiring, because at the end of the day, the people who are printing the money, now this is kind of hard to understand unless you really think about it a little bit, don't care what the actual face value of the money is. What they care about is that they're still the reserve currency, because they don't care if it's worth the full value of a dollar or if it's worth 20 cents on the dollar. As long as they can take that green paper, give it to you, and you give them your manufactured goods, your oil resources, and whatever else it is you're selling. And that's how you maintain control of the global economic system. And as these other countries move more rapidly towards baskets of currencies, what we see is a greater democratization of currency. And I think that that threatens the United States' position as a global leader. And that's very much in doubt now, because for 7 years we've seen the Bush administration basically undermine America's power economically, politically, and militarily. So I don't expect that to change anytime soon.
Well, I'm going to have a little fun with you, Mike. You know, I like to fact-check my guests a little ahead of time. Nothing fancy, just the usual, you know, criminal checks and ask sure. The neighbors. And a couple of things stood out about you. First of all, last February, you publicly predicted the U.S. dollar would collapse in 2007. How do you feel about that prediction now?
Well, I think that it hasn't collapsed in the sense that it's completely, collapsed in the sense that it's Weimar Republic and it's no longer worth anything, but I think we've seen a pretty straight trajectory from the time Bush took office when it was 85 cents on the euro to now when I believe it's $1.47, that we've seen a consistent downward trajectory to the dollar, and at the present rate, could the United States survive with a currency like that if it were going in that same direction uninterrupted for the next 8 or 10 years, and I think that would describe collapse. It would be as I said many times, eye to eye with the peso, and it's certainly headed in that direction.
Well, the other thing that struck me was, apparently, and tell me if I've got this wrong, reading the U.S. housing market a little bit ahead of the curve, you sold your house. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. But, you know, I'd like to clarify that because we owned our house outright, lived there for 27 years, 5 acres, and raised my kids there, had great emotional attachment to it. The house went up between 5 to 6 times its original value, and my wife and I frankly said, I had read probably 14 or 15 articles about the housing bubble. I have no crystal ball. People are patting me on the back saying, well, you predicted the housing bubble. That's not true. The information was out there. It's just that the media does its best to obscure the political and economic information, which create an informed public enough to make intelligent decisions about their own economic and political lives, you know. And so I finally, after reading the really banner story in The Economist explaining in detail how much was, you know, how dire this equity bubble was related to the housing thing, that you can see with certainty that the housing prices were going to go down quite dramatically, and that this was all created by the cheap credit which was produced by the Federal Reserve. And so we sold out 2 years ago, and we're in Kiplinger magazine, and it pretty much framed like we were kind of nutcases at the time. Of course, no one's laughing now. It's a very serious situation. So I stick by that prediction.
Well, I would guess so. Now, for the average person who's just starting to get introduced, I mean, some people have kind of noticed on their daily jobs that things aren't looking so good. What kind of sources should they be looking at? Where can we get some good information about what's going on?
You know, The media likes to come in when something is actually taking place, when the tragedy is actually unfolding, and then give you some detail to maintain their own credibility. That is not just, and then people tend to believe that, well, they're finally coming clean. That's not the case at all. That's not the case about Iraq, where coverage has been reduced by approximately 30%. Because now they just want to disappear the war from the pages of the newspapers and from the TV journalism. And the same is true of the housing bubble, the falling dollar, and the problems in the stock market. Everyone has to accept responsibility for their own economic futures to some extent, because the media basically represents the vested interests of the 1% of the people who own them. And those people also sit on the same boards of Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and McDonnell Douglas. So you cannot expect that these people have your interests at heart. So stop thinking that you can dump off your money or your savings at Joe at the local Fidelity or whatever, and he's going to manage it appropriately for you. You have to do some investigation yourself. This is a very fluid market. It's a very volatile situation, and it requires that everyone educate themselves to a certain extent.
Well, I'd like to look just briefly at the environment itself. You know, some deep green thinkers are actually hoping the consumer colossus falls into a deep pit and stays there, and then finally that whole conveyor belt that turns tropical jungles and horribly mined foreign metals into shopping trinkets that nobody needs, it'll slow down or even stop, and the Earth does need a rest from pointless consumption and endless trash dumps. But this is a really painful way to go if this is how we go. Could this financial trouble have a green lining, in your opinion?
It could have, if it creates the basis for more international cooperation among independent sovereign nations. Right now we're operating, I think you probably agree, under a model of world governance where the United States is essentially, and its allies are calling the shots for the rest of the world, and the people who are calling the shots in the United States are a cartel of the largest corporations in the world. I think we can see after the last 7 years, with the expansion of war, with the depletion of resources, with this vigorous campaign in the media to dissuade people from believing in even something as basic as global warming or peak oil, all these things are being obfuscated in the media. this model is a complete failure. Am I anti-capitalist? I'm not going to go that far to say that. What I'm saying is that the model we're working with right now has us on a path to catastrophe, and I don't think anyone would deny that. I mean, the wars now extend from the southern tip of Somalia all the way to the northern tip of Afghanistan. It's a war zone. And this is not a way that we can reach any kind of consensus on the basically species-threatening issues that we're facing. So we need more consensus, and I'm afraid that we need the United States to be a little more diminished in its military power and its prowess and its position in the world, which, of course, Bush is accommodating us in quite nicely, so that there's more democratization among the independent states of the world so that we can reach some kind of agreement about these issues.
We've been speaking with indie journalist Mike Whitney from Washington State. Mike, what have we left out, and how can people find out more about your work or contact you?
I appear on a number of different websites, Counterpunch, Information Clearinghouse, and a number of Dissident Voice, Market Oracle. But what I'd really like to get across to your listeners more than anything else is to figure out some way to investigate these issues yourself. There's a lot of very good insider information on the Internet. And if you want to email me, I'll identify the different websites that you may be interested in, that you can verify what I'm saying. I don't claim to be an expert or the last word on these issues. But the fact that the stock market went up today or goes down tomorrow is no indication of whether or not what I'm telling you is the truth. The economic situation right now is very dire, and people need to prepare themselves for what could happen and how it's going to affect their jobs and their futures. So I guess that wraps it up.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks for talking and helping us out here on Radio EcoShock. Maybe someday soon the hedge fund operators will be picking tomatoes and making a real living. And let's talk again as the situation develops.
Thank you very much, Alex. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again.
That was indie journalist Mike Whitney, and this is Radio EcoShock. We'll be right back with Ian Angus on climate and capitalism. Can we reform capitalism to save the climate? Ian Angus doesn't think so. Angus believes, quote, ecological destruction is not an accidental feature of capitalism. It is built into the system's DNA. Ian Angus spoke on climate and capitalism at Langara College, Vancouver, on November 15, 2007.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming. Like Dion and the liberals before them, like Bush in the U.S., Harper and the Conservatives don't actually want to do very much about climate change. They have been spending an awful lot of time, and the corporations that fund them have been spending a lot of time, trying to avoid doing anything about climate change. And they have been doing that extremely well. Until this year, the corporate strategy for avoiding action on climate change has mostly been in stage one, denial. This stage has involved two main tactics. Number one is arguing that there is enormous uncertainty about climate change. In fact, arguing that there's a big question about whether there's any problem at all. And at the same time, trying to convince the victims of global warming, that is us, that it's really our fault if it does exist. We did it. The uncertainty card has been played very, very effectively. So let me just be really clear on this. There is no doubt whatsoever that global warming is occurring at an unprecedented rate and that it is caused by human activity, and that if we don't stop it by the end of this century, the planet will be hotter than it has ever been since humans walked the Earth. Only a few cranks disagree with that. But that has not stopped corporate and political leaders from claiming that they don't have enough information to decide if the problem even exists, let alone what might have to be done about it. In fact, virtually any article you read about global warming includes a quote from so-called experts who deny that global warming exists. They seem to represent a vast network of climate change deniers. The Financial Post has been running a series that's up to about number 40 of profiles of various deniers. Maybe it's well past 40 by now. But there certainly seem to be an awful lot of them. Well, in January of this year, the Union of Concerned Scientists published a study that demonstrated something quite intriguing. And that is this very vocal network of global warming deniers was in fact comprised of an extremely small group of people who worked through something like 30 different front groups. They are paid to make global warming look uncertain. The report showed that the main funding for these groups comes from ExxonMobil, which is, by the way, the world's largest publicly traded company, and as I say, it paid them to manufacture uncertainty. The report described this as the most sophisticated and most successful disinformation campaign since the tobacco industry tried to convince the world that tobacco doesn't cause cancer. And in fact, by the way, there are documents that show that they literally studied how the tobacco industry did it and set out to create exactly the same tactics. ExxonMobil, by no coincidence whatsoever, is the world's single largest corporate producer of greenhouse gases. If ExxonMobil was a country, it would be the sixth largest source of carbon dioxide and related emissions in the entire world. So while ExxonMobil was doing the job of funding the people who were trying to produce doubt, other corporate and government agencies were working hard to divert attention from the large-scale pollution that's caused by the fossil fuel industry. These groups have focused on blaming the victims for not cutting back, for not insulating our walls, for not using low-power light bulbs. Some of you may remember the Rick Mercer one-ton challenge commercials, in which he repeatedly went on the air and said, if all of us just reduced our own personal emissions by one ton, the world would be a much better place. Well, it probably would be, but in fact, it wouldn't make much of a dent in the problem of global warming. Yes, indeed, people, the message of all of this was, global warming is your fault. You did it. Clean up your act. Now, I am not criticizing conservation. It's important. We should do what we can. But as long as the fossil fuel giants continue business as usual, such individual efforts are going to have very little effect. But the denial strategy, which has been in effect for some years now, has just about reached the end of its rope. First, the scientific evidence for global warming gets more powerful every day. The IPCC reports, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that were issued this year, represent a conservative consensus of the overwhelming majority of scientists, and very few serious objections have been made to those reports. More generally, despite the confusion and misinformation that has been spread by the denial industry, public concern about climate change has actually grown remarkably over the past year or two. Voters and customers want action. So what we're seeing now is that George Bush and Stephen Harper and even ExxonMobil have moved into the second stage of avoiding action on climate change. The second stage involves demonstratively jumping on the green bandwagon and trying to take it over. Stage two, this acceptance, has three components: greenwash, talk, and solutions that do nothing. Greenwash isn't new. We've been seeing it from many of the world's biggest polluters for years. Even ExxonMobil is joining in the game right now. It recently announced that it has stopped funding all those groups that the Union of Concerned Scientists identified as front groups, which is probably true that they have stopped, because there's not a lot of point in having front groups if everybody knows they're front groups. And they have announced meetings with environmental groups to discuss what legislators might do and so on. The British environmental writer George Monbiot recently had this to say about these image-making efforts of the oil industry. By repositioning themselves in this way as environmentally responsible, they have created the impression that a large and growing oil industry is compatible with runaway climate change. The adverts, in other words, all appear to be examples of greenwash, companies attempting to distract attention from the environmental impacts of their activities. Speaking about the Alberta tar sands, Stéphane Dion said, "There is no minister of the environment on earth who can stop this from going forward because there is too much money in it." Tar sands oil, mostly produced in Alberta, is the world's most harmful type of oil for the atmosphere. Getting oil out of the tar sands generates 2.5 to 3 times as much greenhouse gases as conventional oil production. So I'm not talking about what the oil itself produces, I'm talking about the simple effort of getting it out of the ground generates 2.5 to 3 times as much greenhouse gases as traditional oil. The Alberta tar sands are the single largest reason why Canada's greenhouse gas emissions have risen drastically since this country signed the Kyoto Accord. But there's too much money in it, so Dion let it go ahead. So much for the single most important environmental issue facing the world today. Then, having gone through interesting speeches and greenwash, the next stage for the politicians and their corporate friends is to turn to solutions that don't solve anything. Last year, our leading economist Nicholas Stern was reported to the British government on climate change, and his report identified, I think quite accurately ultimately, the source of the problem. He said, "Greenhouse gas emissions are an externality. In other words, our emissions affect the lives of others. When people do not pay for the consequences of their actions, we have a market failure. This is the greatest market failure the world has seen." Externality is a term that capitalist economists use to describe what happens when capitalist corporations don't pay for the damage they cause. Pollution is the perfect example. Individual corporations pollute, but society as a whole bears the cost. The so-called free market, which is supposedly the source of all our wealth and comfort, never deals effectively with externalities. The invisible hand doesn't work. So what should we do about that? Well, some naive, innocent people might conclude that if it's the market that's screwing up, we should stop relying on the market. But no. Nicholas Stern and most government policymakers, on the contrary, say that since markets have failed, let's create more markets. This takes various solutions, but almost all of them involve putting a monetary value on the right to pollute. So if a corporation decides to cut emissions, if it decides it's too expensive to cut emissions, it can buy pollution credits from some other company or for the government, or it can fund green projects in the third world. And all that is, by the way, written into the Kyoto Accord. That's its principal proposal for how to deal with the problem, is to allow people to buy their way out of polluting. George Monbiot has compared this to the medieval practices of selling indulgences, quite apart from the just bizarre idea that the air we have to breathe should somehow be available for sale to the highest bidder. Let's take the simple fact that it's virtually impossible to measure the results of what's called carbon trading. It's subject to massive fraud, and that's been thoroughly exposed in many cases. There's a report published early this year by the Dag Hammarskjöld Institute that proves not only that emissions trading doesn't work, that is, there is zero evidence after all the experiments with emissions trading that's been done in Europe that it's produced any results whatsoever, but it actually makes things worse because it delays actions. So that's one concept, one approach to coping with greenhouse gases by doing something that doesn't in fact change anything. But you know, here in Canada, the Harper government, and by the way in the US, the Bush government, thought even that was too much like actually doing something. So they proposed an approach that was originally dreamed up by the first Bush government, and which has been in liberal programs and conservative programs ever since, instead of demanding that the polluters reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, they propose that we should use carbon more efficiently. Instead of mandatory emission reductions, they want a voluntary plan. And it won't deal with actual emissions, it will deal with emissions intensity, which means reducing the amount of greenhouse gas that's produced for each unit of production. So the amount of greenhouse gas that an industry would generate, say, per gallon of oil or per car produced or whatever, would be reduced. We'd be more efficient. Now, that sounds good. But if production rises faster than emission intensity goes down, the total emissions actually rise under that scenario. And that is not some hypothetical case. Between 1990 and 2004, Canada's emissions intensity improved 14%, but our total emissions rose 27%. Got more efficient, but produced substantially more as a result. Under the proposal that has come out of the federal government this year, the tar sands projects in Alberta would meet their targets for emissions intensity while still increasing their total emissions by 300%. Emissions intensity basically is a method of setting up targets that corporations will meet anyway, because corporations are constantly trying to reduce their costs and improve their efficiency. But they do it in order to increase market share, which means they do it in order to increase their production. And as these numbers show, and by the way, that's pretty much the way it's worked globally, intensity has improved, but emissions have increased much more. Now, this has to seem a little odd. If you're a reasonable human being, you have to start asking, why do corporations and governments work so hard to stop doing anything or to avoid doing anything about climate change? The Earth is heating up. Our climate is going crazy. Everybody on Earth is going to be affected, and that everybody includes capitalists. It includes the corporations. It includes the politicians. We'll all be affected. Many corporations will be totally destroyed by climate change. Nicholas Stern's estimate, and it's generally viewed he was optimistic, Nicholas Stern estimated that if we don't act, the world's economy will shrink by 20% in this century. And that's a huge reduction. So why don't the people in power do something? The answer, unfortunately, is that the problem isn't rooted in the goodwill or bad will of individuals. It's rooted in the very nature of capitalist society, which is made up of thousands of corporations, all competing for investments and growth and profit. Capital, by its very nature, by its DNA, has to grow. There's no point in investing capital in an enterprise unless I expect to get back more than I put in, unless my capital grows. If I own a big company and I decide that I'm going to invest heavily in cutting greenhouse gas emissions, my profits are going to go down, investors will go elsewhere, they'll take their money out of my company and put it into companies that have higher profits that aren't wasting their money, in capitalist terms, on unproductive investment. Eventually, I'll go out of business. The law of capitalism is grow or die. Anarchic, unplanned growth is not an accident. It isn't a market failure. It's the nature of the beast. Joel Koval writes in the current issue of Canadian Dimension magazine, "Capitalism as such cannot accept limits on its growth any more than a person can cease to breathe. It's fundamental to the system." And because it has to grow, it has to use more raw materials, it has to use more resources, it has to use more energy, it has to generate more greenhouse gases. We're constantly bombarded by propaganda arguing that growth is good. Good pretty much by definition. The main argument that Harper and Bush and Stelmach and others make against cutting greenhouse gas emissions is that it will interfere with growth. And all you have to do if you're a politician is stand up and say, I won't do anything to stop economic growth, and it's instantly that is a good thing. Quote. But what is the measure of growth that we're talking about here? Are we talking about people being better off, better educated, healthier? No. The measure of growth is how much gets sold every day, every week, every year. That includes thousands upon thousands of products that are directly harmful to humans and to nature. It includes commodities that cannot be produced without spreading disease, destroying the forests, poisoning our water, poisoning our air. Doesn't matter. It's growth. That's the way the system measures growth. Growth is so important to capitalism that the system sustains a multi-billion dollar industry whose only role is to manipulate human psychology to create wants, not needs, so that the ever-growing pile of commodities will in fact be purchased. In 2005, the total U.S. spending on advertising was $143 billion. By way of comparison, the Stern Report on Global Warming estimated that the total cost of dealing effectively with global warming, total, not yearly, total cost, would be about $617 billion. So we could cut emissions and adapt to avoid unavoidable changes for less than the USA alone spends on advertising in 5 years. Let me add the obvious statement, by the way, that U.S. military spending is something over $626 billion a year. So that could solve the problem all by itself. But making bombs and tanks and fighter planes and commercials contributes to growth. Ending global warming doesn't. So the money doesn't get spent there. This profound commitment to growth at all costs means that waste and pollution are not accidental side effects of the system we live in. Calling global warming the result of market failure misses the fact that it is a direct and inevitable result of capitalist growth. That's obvious in the numbers. A study by the World Resources Institute found that between one-half and three-quarters of the resource inputs used by industrial economies are returned to the environment as waste within 12 months. Within 12 months of our economy using natural resource inputs, those half to three-quarters of them are returned as pollution, as landfill, as global warming gas. That's what capitalism does with natural resources. It trashes them. It turns them into landfill and pollution and greenhouse gases. As John Bellamy Foster writes, the market system cannot possibly absorb or pay for the damage it costs. So those costs are either unpaid or offloaded onto society as a whole. The ecological economist William Kapp put it much more simply. He said, capitalism must be regarded as an economy of unpaid costs. And when you talk about that volume of environmental destruction created by every input, none of that cost paid, none of that destruction of our environment, you see why Kapp said it was unpaid costs. We live in an economy that is based on the earth, the historical wealth of this earth going unpaid and subsidizing the profits of corporations. That's why capitalism cannot solve global warming. The solutions are going to involve major shifts in production and consumption patterns, in particular reducing our use of energy. It's going to involve massive spending and wrenching economic change. In capitalist terms, that's all going to be non-profitable investment, and that's in an economy that cannot function without profit. The solutions are going to have to be global. Air and water don't stop at human borders. Only an economy that will require radical reorganization of the economy on a global level and taking global issues into account, not offloading our pollution onto the third world, which is what we've been doing over the past couple of decades, sending our dirtiest industries to China and India and South America. Only an economy that's organized for human needs, not for profit, has any chance of slowing global warming and reversing the damage that's already been done. Only democratic socialist planning can overcome the problems that are caused by capitalist anarchy. Only a system that gives priority to human needs and the restoration of ecosystems can stop and then reverse global warming. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to wait for socialism to do anything. On the contrary, it's critical that we fight for change now. It's very possible to win some important gains, and building the movement for such gains will be an important part of building a movement for socialism. In my view, a radical movement against global warming can be built around these kinds of demands, and I think they will evolve over time, but these are the kinds of things that we should be fighting for in the present framework. The government must establish and enforce rapid, mandatory reductions in CO2 emissions. Real reductions, not phony trading plans or intensity improvements. You know, when you read the books, I'm currently reading a book called Hot Air, which is a very good account of Canadian global warming policy, but they go into how long this is all going to take. There's a whole discussion of how long it takes to restructure and redirect industry. It's going to take decades to do anything. When World War II broke out, and the Canadian government and the leaders of Canada decided that this was a fight worth fighting, they literally sat down with the major corporations, the car manufacturers to start with, and said, you are now going to reorient production to produce tanks and ships and all the things we need to win this war. And you know they did it, and they did it in months. They completely redirected our economy. The car industry in Canada stopped making cars for the duration. You can have whatever attitude or evaluation you would like of World War II. My point is that if you want to make these changes, if you're serious about making them, you can do it. But it requires a willingness to take on profit as a motivator. We have to insist that the companies that produce greenhouse gases pay the full cost of cutting the emissions. We have to stop subsidies to oil, gas, and coal. You know, one of the things about the greenhouse, about the Alberta tar sands, one of the reasons they have grown so fast is, and have generated so much greenhouse gas in the process, is that they are extensively subsidized by the federal and provincial governments that are involved through tax breaks of all kinds, and by paying far less than the cost of getting of the raw materials they're using. And we need to redirect the billions that are now being spent on wars and debt payments into public transit, into retrofitting buildings for energy efficiency, and into renewable energy projects. At the same time, the movement against climate change has to win the support of the labor movement and give support to third world victims of global warming. Corporations and conservative union leaders play on the fear of job losses to convince industrial workers to oppose the environmental movement. We see this constantly. And sadly, on the side of the green movement, we frequently see a kind of equal view of things. I hear people call for shutting down the tar sands. I rarely hear anybody saying, what happens to the thousands of workers and who are employed in the tar sands, what happens to the people whose jobs depend on those people, and so on. Those people are not responsible for global warming, and they shouldn't have to pay the price. So part of the demand for restructuring industry has to be coupled with opposition to layoffs, to full access to retraining and relocation at the corporation's expense, at full union pay. And we need to support the third world in its struggle against domination and distortion of their economies. There's been a lot of material in the paper this year about how China has had an extraordinary increase in the amount of greenhouse gases that it produces. And that's true, although on a per capita basis, China remains very, very far behind what happens routinely in Canada, the United States, and Europe. One of the reasons it has such large emission levels is simply its huge population. But there's another huge factor in China, and that is that corporations in North America and Europe have been actively exporting their dirtiest production to China. This huge economic growth that we hear about in China, there was a report came out a couple of weeks ago, between 25 and 30% of all Chinese production is exported to Europe and North America. So whose greenhouse gases are there was the question. Are those, was asked. We need to stop dumping pollution on the third world. We need to export clean technologies. We need to help the third world focus on agriculture for use, not for export and profit, because one of the worst things that's been happening, a huge greenhouse gas generator, and it's done in the name of cleaning things up. is the shift to biofuel, where we see in Europe, European governments saying we want to stop using petroleum, so we want to shift over to fuels made from plants. And they're giving subsidies to companies that do that. So what those companies are doing is moving into countries like Indonesia and Uganda, Paraguay, driving peasants off the land, cutting down huge forests and planting huge amounts of monocultures, soy in Paraguay, palm trees in Indonesia, onto farms whose size utterly beggars the imagination. And I'm talking literally about hundreds of square miles and single production units. They produce enormous amounts of greenhouse gases, and they, of course, take food and water away from the people who live in those areas. To stop doing that. The example of Cuba, which is a very poor country with very limited resources, shows what can be done. The World Wildlife Fund recently reviewed a whole set of countries, and they identified Cuba as the only country in the world that meets the requirements of sustainable development. Now, Cuba is a poor country, and nobody would say that's the way we should live or the way the world should live. But nevertheless, what it shows is development is possible without producing massive greenhouse gases, because this happened. Cuba has a sustainable economy that does not pollute the environment at a time when its economy has been growing twice as fast as the Latin American average. In 1918, in the midst of the most horrible war the world had ever seen, the great socialist, German socialist leader Rosa Luxemburg wrote that the choice facing the world at that time was socialism or barbarism. And as we know, socialism did not triumph in the 20th century. Instead, what we had was a century of wars and genocide. The very barbarism that Rosa Luxemburg had warned was inevitable if that capitalist system remained in place. Today we face that choice in a new and potentially even more destructive form. Echoing Marx and Engels and echoing Rosa Luxemburg, we can say that humanity's choice in the 21st century is eco-socialism or barbarism. There is no third way. Thank you.
That was Climate and Capitalism by Ian Angus. This speech was recorded on November 15, 2007 at Langara College, Vancouver, by Radio EcoShock. Find out more about Ian Angus and the alternatives to capitalism at his blog, Climate and Capitalism. That's www.climateandcapitalism.blogspot.com. Coming up next week on Radio EcoShock, a vital speech by NASA scientist James Hansen, delivered in Texas this October. He explains how the Earth hit a hot state 55 million years ago without us, and why we're heading back there in a hurry with fossil fuels. This is one of the best climate speeches of 2007. Well, thanks for hanging out with me. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and let's meet again next week. We're going out with The House of Trouble by Clatter. Find them at clatter.com.
This is the most serious problem facing humanity in the 21st century. If we don't address it, we'll undermine and perhaps destroy civilization.